PPI.org. FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview.
And I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, David talks with Brian Cherry, the author of two collections of poems, Funeral Journey and Ruins, Ruminations and Rituals. In his work, he attempts to navigate space between a solitary moment and the expanse of eternity. Born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, he has been shaped by his experiences in his home city. His work has appeared in Return to the Gathering Waters anthology and Permeable to the Year.
I'm Liz Old. In the second part of our show, Annie will be talking with Catherine Silver, an award-winning literary translator and the former director of the Banff International Literary Translation Center. Her most recent and forthcoming translations include works by Maria Sonia Christoph, Daniel Sada, and Cesar Ara. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Hi, Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Wonderful. Thanks for being with us tonight. Why don't we kick something off, Brian, with a poem or a reading, and then talk about it. What you going to read for us?
So I think we're lucky enough nowadays to be able to see a lot of poets that we like reading their stuff online or videos that they filmed when they were alive. So this is a poem about doing that. It's called Awesome. Why Compare Reading Having a Coke With You. Cigarette is held as if transformed into right hand afterthought. Where's the ash that cigarette created? This was 1966. It is now 52 years after he listed places that I still have no idea about. That ash has to be somewhere. Probably not as ash, but as what and where. 52 years ago was 1 year after Congress decreed that packs of cigarettes carry a warning. Caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. This mosaic man whose eyes grazed the camera exactly 4 times in the 1 minute and 45 seconds, who mentioned 7 severed locales which rise through the fragmentation, occasionally moves the cigarette to rhythm on the emphasis words. Was he concerned about what this eternal cigarette and all the other smoky silhouette-inducing cylinders, colloquially squares, might do to him? So many cigarette pictures of this man, so much zagging language, like Chinese lanterns aflame in the sky, filled with numerous, luminous, cold constellations. The sky, his gentle tongue. In a few short numbered days from this poem's recitation, Fire Island waits to cull him. I just hope he was not concerned about the potential for cigarette deaths. It helps me to believe that those ashes endings are now somehow a part of a red-winged blackbird stumbling about in dew-damp Kentucky bluegrass in nascent Midwest spring, that at least some of his body's molecules have become grime, that is, mucking up the painting of a young man on his horse at the Frick Collection in New York.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
It often happens when one of our poets kicks off the show with a reading that it happens to be one of my favorite poems, and I do love this one, so thank you for reading it.
Thank you.
It touches on some themes that we're going to get to, but before we do that, Brian, let's talk a little bit about you. As we heard from Josh at the top of the show, born and raised in Milwaukee. Are you still in Milwaukee?
I am, yeah.
So tell us about Milwaukee and your life there, because it shows up in your poems, and give us a little bit of a, you know, background about you and your life and where this writing comes from.
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up on the north side of Milwaukee, Central City, a lot of beauty there. You know, in some ways it was a depressed area in a lot of ways, okay. But there was still a lot of beauty that shone through. grew up with my parents. My mom is a writer. My father has worked as a truck driver for, you know, past 35 years, whatever it is. Big family. I'm the oldest of 8 children.
Oh, wow.
Kind of, you know, had some interesting perspectives just because I went to school, like elementary school all the way through high school in like the suburban area, area of the city. So like I kind of had that back and forth pull push going on between that. And, you know, once I got done with college, there was really nowhere else that I wanted to be. You know, it's a great city. You know, through a lot of things, like a lot of places are right now, but it's a great city.
Yeah, I agree. It's a fun city. I know it from visiting. Is most of your family still in Milwaukee then?
Yeah, the majority. Cool. I just have one sister who's, she's a pediatrician down in Nashville. So, but other than that, everybody's still in the area.
Great. Well, if you have we won't read it right now, but later on, if you have a poem in mind that really says Milwaukee for you, let me know. I have one picked out that might be, and that's called and then parens for 16th and Atkinson. I'm assuming that's a corner, street corner in Milwaukee, but maybe we can talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah.
To kick things off, let's talk about a couple poems from Funeral Journey. One is called When I Was a War Zone, which is a very grabbing title. And then a couple pages after that, which I really like too, is Pear in a Bluish Ceramic Bowl. Totally different sort of poem, but boy, sure. I just love it for a lot of different ways. Because I think this gets at sort of the breadth of your work, and there's a lot of good stuff here, Brian. I enjoyed reading it. But let's talk about When I Was a War Zone, and it's almost impossible not to bring up a poem with that title and not reflect a little bit on what's been going on the last unfortunate couple of weeks, and frankly, for the last unfortunate many, 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 many years.
Yep.
If you want to read some of that from us, or you just want to talk about it, maybe set us up, tell us what this is about and where this came from.
Yeah, so it's funny. It's one of the poems that came fairly quickly and came with like a flood of passion behind it. Yeah. I think it touches on a lot of different things that are going on, you know, the over militarization of, you know, the police or just the military in general, like how much our society builds that up. It also touches upon like the mental health aspect of it. What effect this can have on people living in these communities. But that's, you know, it's where it ended up. I'm not sure if that's where I meant to start it at, but it is certainly something that anytime I go back to this this collection, it's something that kind of pops out for me, this poem. So I'll read that if that's all right with you.
That would be great. I think that's entirely appropriate. Thank you, Brian.
When I was a war zone, picked bullets out with dainty hands out of gap-filled teeth, watched as smoke exhaled my lungs, as my linguistics struggled to choke out a proper way to crave death. Took delicate bones from frenzied birds as they reacted to me, as they would to a weather's wild phrases. Lapped up poison with crimson tongue, wept in a manufactured fashion, allowed my chest cavity to be propaganda. The fighter jets, their wreckage intercourse, dropping seeds to bloom slaughter. At ease, in my bloat legs, kinetically, generals exhorted this to children. Inner turmoil, a flank exposed in my eyes. Enemy is within, without surrender. The savaged mental health. Feed, we must feed, I must feed. Contortions upon full-on spirit abortions. Razors, sticky, abundant losers. Filling up my innards with the spoils are the winners. Black gold mine veins, split my lizard brain.
Thank you. That's very powerful. I recently, this week, listened to a Gil Scott-Heron reading, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Yeah. And how do you feel, Brian, as an African-American man, and what poetry can do? And you're an artist beyond that, and we can talk about that too. I get the sense from your poetry that you're a visual artist and a musician too, so good for you. But the purpose and power of poetry in times like this, does it work for you? Does it resonate?
Well, I think for me, the power in poetry as it hits me, like I can only speak for myself, you know, of course, but the way that it breaks you up and takes you out of time and allows you to slow down. You have to slow down to kind of try and process what's going on. That that process of slowing down is something that can help through anything that's going on in your life. The current situation, like you can't just rush into things. You gotta take the time to slow down and see what's really formulating in your body, and then attack that. Once you know what you want to do, attack that. But I think poetry has the potential to, outside of just opening people up to being slower, it also has the potential to give people power, because they can navigate and write poetry in whatever style they want to, because nobody can tell you what a poem really means, you know? But it may open them up to being like, you know, oh, I can do this, and this helps me express what I'm feeling about this current situation right now. And I think that's a very powerful door that's open for people when that happens.
Great. Thank you. I agree. And I think your poetry does that, and poems do that in general, make us stop, check ourselves, and think about our place in whatever situation we're in, and our place in the universe. And that's the next subject I want to get to with you. But I want to remind our gentle listeners out there that we are speaking with Brian Cherry from Milwaukee, and talking about his two collections of poetry, Funeral Journey and Ruins, Ruminations and Rituals. And why I mention the universe in your poetry is it seems to pop up a lot, Brian. And your relationship, our relationship with infinity, with space, with the universe, it pops up a lot, and sometimes it surprises me. And it does again in the second poem I mentioned, Pear in a Bluish Ceramic Bowl, which I want to ask you to read so we have some time to talk some other things too. I want to give you a chance to talk about this, but where does this come from, this idea? And you also bring up other elements of science in your poetry also, from biology to evolution. Why does your brain go there? Is this part of your background, or?
Well, not necessarily. I guess, you know, I went to school for like politics and history.
Okay.
You know, I think in that I kind of saw the repeating themes, narratives that happen for different societies, humanity as a whole. And I'm intrigued by science. I'm intrigued by like the Big Bang and stuff like that. For what it means, whether you want to think of it as a metaphor or not, like there's a lot of beauty in the fact that you can think of everything being in this one tiny, 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 tiny dot that just exploded into everything. Because if you can wrap your mind around that thought, then you can wrap your mind around the thought that we're all one thing kind of expressing itself in different, you know, formations or mutations, whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of that comes from.
I see. And in that poem, you reference a child, perhaps your child, but very nicely linking to all those themes you just described and to our relationship with other people and whatnot. Anyway, you do that very, very nicely. Is the Gemini in Ruins, Ruminations and Rituals, Gemini on page 70, it feels like a like the brief story of Brian Cherry's life. Is it sort of a
well, you know,
the life of Brian Cherry?
No, not at all. I am a gentleman, but it's not about me. It's about one of my best friends in the world, actually.
Okay.
So, like,
it reads as a nice story.
Yeah. It was fun to kind of just enshrine somebody else's experience from what I've gleaned from being around him for so long. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, in terms of that, leads to my follow-up question. In terms of where you get your ideas, family shows up in here. Milwaukee shows up in here. Science, we talked about that. Do you look for inspiration for your poems? Does it find you? Or
well, I think that inspiration is something that can be in anything that's happening to you. You know, like what's happening right now could be a poem because there's the disparate parts that. You know, I have a painting right here, which is kind of this weird cat thing. You know, I have my phone, which is a whole another rabbit hole of things you can write about your phone. And it's just so really, yeah. I try and take inspiration out of everything that happens. I try and write every day, but I've set the bar truly really low. You know, like I'm just trying to, you know, write what's happening. And that poem that we were talking about previously about my son, it's almost exactly as it happened the first half. And then my mind just kind of unspooled into the, you know, the bigger picture of what's going on with that.
Right. Now we talked about and 416th and Atkinson, mm-hmm. which again references a particular corner in Milwaukee, I believe. That's the guess. Yep. That's on page 43 of Ruins. You want to read some of that for us, Brian? And maybe we'll talk about why that particular corner means something to you?
Yeah.
Please.
And for 16th and Atkinson. I remember trying to throw gang signs and assorted convoluted handshakes and fire hydrants being opened on the 90 degree days and the corner store selling penny candy for 5 cents and trash strewn everywhere. And spontaneous rap men spontaneously rapping and stealing chromes off people's tires and basketball in the alley on a milk crate and loose pit bulls and running and the drug house across the street and pee in his wheelchair. He got gapped by the gang and teenage girls working their bodies in holy gyrations in the streets to the hip hop and the folks bursting heavens out of the liquor stores with their booty blinded in black bag concealment, and the grandmothers hovering over youth with lips pursed with variations on the theme of slow down, and entrepreneur middle schoolers, depending on the season, cutting grass or shoveling snow for $5, and the man on the corner carrying on 6 conversations with himself, and the gunshots having young parents screaming for their progeny to get down on the damn floor, and the beatific strangulation of being poor when everyone you know is poor too, and men and women who went off to college coming home to inspire, and the glorious scrum of music, always the music blasting from there to here, and the trauma passed down through generations, and the strength passed down through generations, and the smiles and the mean mugs, and the cannabis wafting at illusory angles, and the prisms of light, and the moon would sometimes make passing cars appear to be UFOs glinting in windows, and love cascading through families, and men and women working their asses off at menial blue-collar or white-collar jobs, and food, meals for everyone to consecrate and break down walls and stereotypes plied by the media, and...
Man, that is so good. I hate to even talk right away after it. Beautifully read, Brian. For listeners, this is a block of type on a page, a few commas here and there in appropriate places, and one long sentence that ends with and. Very powerful. So tell us about 16th and Atkinson and where this poem came from.
That's where I grew up in Milwaukee for the majority of my life. It's right off of a main three thoroughfare that goes through Milwaukee, Capitol Drive. But this block was important to me because I learned so much from watching people, things I wanted to do, things I didn't want to do, just like anywhere else. But, you know, this is where I happen to come from. And these are things that actually happened, you know, like Spontaneous Rat Man was my brothers and sisters and I, we used to call this guy Spontaneous Rat Man because he just spontaneously started rapping down the street. You know?
Wow.
All this stuff is like, it's fun to let that bubble up into another reality of a poem, you know?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful description of place. It just really comes alive, and even more so when you read it. I think you saw the amazing Josh Weber hold up the 2-minute warning, which is amazing to me that we're there already. Because this has gone too fast. So before we lose you, let us know how we can keep up with you, keep in touch with you. Are you have a website or what?
Yeah.
Tell us what we can do here.
Sure. So I have a personal website, which is briancherry.com, but with the website, it's B-R-Y-A-N, cherry, T-R-R-Y.com. And you can go to, if you do /poetry, that'll come up. If you just go to the regular B-R-Y-A-N, cherry.com, it'll be my music page, but /poetry will bring you to my poetry site.
Awesome.
So I have another chapbook that I'm currently shopping around now at this point. And it's funny because it's called Making Love in End Times. And it was done last summer, but now it's kind of seems like it's on the nose. So who knows? Yeah.
Well, if you can send me a copy, send us a copy electronically, whatever you can. We'd like to keep up with you and then maybe have you back on the show.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
This has been fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's what's up next. Do you readings in Milwaukee for anyone who's listening over there?
Okay. I do a lot of readings in Milwaukee. Awesome. One of the big places is Woodland Pattern.
Okay.
Which is kind of the conduit for Milwaukee poets. I've done readings tons of places. I'm hoping once things are a little bit more normal to start branching out and hitting like Madison, La Crosse, and up through Minneapolis and stuff like that.
Well, if you come here, let us know. We'll have you in the studio. That'd be a gas.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, before I let you go, I'm going to remind everyone that we've been speaking with Brian Cherry, B-R-Y-O-N, except on his website, A-N, easier to remember, briancherry.com, the author of 2 chapbooks of poetry, Funeral Journey and Ruins, Ruminations and Rituals, and a forthcoming chapbook also coming out. That's fantastic. Brian, it's been a real treat and pleasure to have you on our show.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Nice to meet you.
Listening to KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds, and this is your What's Happening calendar of literary events brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. On Wednesday, June 10th, from 6 to 7 p.m., author Henry Buchwald will discuss his new book, Surgical Renaissance in the Heartland, a memoir of the Wangenstein Era, presented by the University of Minnesota Press and the Wangenstein Historical Library. I assume that's virtual, but there's no address, so I would just look up the Wangenstein Historical Library online, and you'll probably find that information. Wednesday, June 10th, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., Books and Bards presents a digital discussion of Stuart Turton's The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Again, there's no address listed on the Rain Taxi calendar site, but if you look up Books and Bards, you'll probably find it. Thursday, June 11th, from 7 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., author Joe Mino will discuss his new book, Between Everything and Nothing, with 2 of the book's subjects, Seydou Mohammed and Razak Ayel, on Majors and Quinn's Facebook page. And on Saturday, June 13th, from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., Minnesota novelist William Kent Kruger and Leif Enger will have a live conversation, again, on Majors and Quinn's Facebook page. And on Monday, June 15th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., to amplify the voices of our Black community members, Next Chapter Booksellers will host a virtual open mic. Any Black writers interested in sharing a story, poem, song, or another form of literature, please email events to coordinator Kylie Davis at that's Riley Davis, at riley@nextchapterbooksellers.com. That's Riley spelled R-I-L-E-Y. Riley at nextchapterbooksellers.com. This has been your What's Happening Literate Calendar of Literary Events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. There are many other events you can check out at the Rain Taxi site at raintaxi.com. You can also check out our podcast archives at www.writeonradio.libsyn.com. And now this.
Well, hello, everyone. You're still on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview, and I am super excited to be having on the show tonight one of my favorite translators, Catherine Silver. She most recently translated Include Me Out, originally by Maria Sonia Christoph, a book that I loved and tore through, but she's translated, I believe, over 30 books, and is the former director of the Banff International Literary Translation Center. So anyway, it's super exciting to have her on the show tonight. Catherine, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Welcome to the show, Catherine. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you for inviting me.
So I believe you have a little sample of Include Me Out that you can share with our friends who are listening tonight.
Yes, I thought I'd just read the first page. It gives a good intro to the book.
Great.
And then we can talk and maybe I'll read some more.
Sounds good.
Okay. This is Include Me Out by Maria Sonia Christoph, translated by Catherine Silver. On some days, she is able to follow the trajectory of a fly without anything or anybody getting in the way. Its circular flight, the color on its abdomen, the blur of its wing beats, its buzzing, the precise instant it lands on a particular surface, its front legs engaged in a kind of frenetic prayer, its huge eyes, a moment of hesitation, its resolute then idling steps, its back legs poised to stalk, to flee, its desperate search for a way out, there, an inch away, a search Mara would assist were her circumstances different. On some days, she manages to convince herself that she has learned to observe as if it were an act of simple confirmation. She sits in her museum guard chair and watches, silent, ecstatic, with no interruptions of any kind. For moments, she believes that her experiment is working. Not always. But on some days, she believes she's enjoying success. And if at one of those moments, a visitor approaches to ask her a question about the museum or where the bathroom is or about the best local restaurant, she emulates the pieces in the exhibit, stares straight ahead at a tiny detail, turns a special quality of attention to how she is sitting, the tensing of her muscles, the expression on her face. To remain silent is also a discipline of the body, according to her manual of rhetoric.
I love that piece as an intro to the book, and it right away got me wrapped up in what this book is all about, which is the intriguing and often strange minutia-based worldview of the protagonist, Mara. I love the way we just start on the micro detail of a fly that most people would swat away and ignore. And I also love the way it drops some references to what will happen later in the book. Thank you for that choice, Catherine.
Thank you for letting me read it.
So you, clearly, as I said at the beginning of the passage, you're a translator, and Mara, the book's protagonist, is an interpreter in that passage. We saw her sitting at the museum in a small town in Argentina where she's working as a translator. And the book, Include Me Out, really hinges on the ways that both silence and spoken and written rhetoric are tools of manipulation and get used as tools of manipulation. Mara herself is very keen to the language that other people use and is very, for the most part, very deliberate about when she speaks and when she doesn't. In addition to how she catalogs and identifies different types of rhetoric and how they get used to steer and manipulate people, in addition to using quiet sometimes as a way to get her own way. As someone who works with language yourself, and quite prolifically, how did you feel about Mara's observations about language, rhetoric, and silence?
Well, one of the things that really drew me to this book when I first read it and made me want to translate it was that I did identify with the protagonist, which is not usually the case in the books I translate. But it was something about her and the way Maria Sonia portrays her and her struggle that I, and the particular period of my own life that I identified with a lot. As a translator, translation and interpretation, I do a lot of interpreting now as well, is an act of empathy. You have to really connect with the other person, which makes you extremely conscious of other people in your midst, even when you're not translating and interpreting. So I see Mara's retreat as a kind of being flung back into a place where she's not tuned into other people and not, not always engaged. There's a kind of engagement one needs as a translator or an interpreter with the other. And then the idea, this whole thing about rhetoric is, yes, it's brilliant. Because she's also been like writing this manual of rhetoric throughout the or during her last year of working. So just one little correction. She goes to this small town in Buenos Aires not to work as a translator, but to work as a museum guard. She abandons her career as a translator or an interpreter. So she goes there trying to find a situation where she does not have to speak, where she can just completely indulge in silence.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that correction. I love knowing the way that you also found that parallelism woven throughout the book and so strongly. Thanks for letting us know about that. Have you ever tried to take a quiet period or a break from a language-immersed life, kind of in the way of Mara, or have you just been straight up on those words for your whole career?
I mean, I actually have been taking a break now from translating, and I actually wrote a book before I sort of finished it before I read this book. And that was the other coincidence. I wrote a book really all about being alone and being silent. So that was also another kind of interesting coincidence.
Yeah. So, as, for in terms of, your work as a translator and, as a conduit for the voices of others, and a co-shaper of those words. The author of this book is Maria Sonia Christoph, who you've, I believe you've also translated False Calm by her, also an Argentinian book. What is your relationship on a communication or personal level like Christoph, with Christoph, like as you've worked through these translations, particularly this one?
Yeah, so I didn't know her at all, and I didn't work with her closely on False Calm, but a lot of translators do work more closely with their authors. That's just not my style. So we had a few communications, a few queries. I sent her a almost final draft. She came back to me with a few queries back and forth. And then she was invited to San Francisco to present the book, and I invited her sight unseen to stay at my house for a week. And we had a lovely time. I think we really enjoyed each other. And I think most of all, we learned to trust each other's sense of humor, which is pretty important between people. So that and then that continued when I did Include Me Out. So that same relationship, very collaborative, very easy.
That warms my heart. That's such a wonderful story. I especially feel like connecting with a fellow word person over humor is such a milestone because humor can be so personal and so rooted in one's ideology and in how one sees the world. That's awesome that, especially in the context of going on to working on this book with Christoph, that's really wonderful. So yeah,
because it is also very fun. It is funny.
Yes. Most of my highlights in this book are just like kind of sly burns that Mara makes. Like at one point, mm-hmm. she's walking around and she passes a park, and she in her mind refers to it as what passes here as a park.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, exactly. sick burn on Luhan here. Speaking of Mara, Mara, as we've hinted at, the protagonist lives with a lot of eccentricities, some of which I feel like might almost verge into being neuroses. And she curates a very solitary life during this era when she is doing her experiment as a museum guard. And I laughed out loud, again on the humor, when she described Ringo, the CSA delivery person, coming into her kitchen for a glass of water. She describes it as a startling intimacy, which I found funny. Mm-hmm. She fixates on and names tiny details of the world, like when you settle down into a chair and your spine touches like the physicality of the chair. She calls that the lumbar moment. So what was it like for you as a translator to, first of all, like even just inhabit this odd character and write while incorporating her voice, and also to just bring her particular lexicon, just bring it over into the totally different linguistic system of English?
So as I said, translating is sort of an act of empathy, and the closest thing I can, the analogy I often use is acting. You have to sort of inhabit in this case, the character, also the author and the author's voice,
mm-hmm.
The character and the author's voice through it. And I think in the cases you mentioned, the trick for a translator there is to trust the author. Mm-hmm. So when she uses the word intimacy to describe the relationship with Ringo, because he sits down at her table when he delivers the groceries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I didn't trust her, I might think, oh, that doesn't seem like the right word. But mm-hmm. clearly, once I translated it, it was perfect and funny, and it totally expressed exactly what Mara's goals were and how she was feeling the world at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And how alone she needed to be. You know, and the lumbar moment is perfect. That's sort of her attempt to just focus on her lower back. You know?
Yeah,
very funny.
Were there any moments in your back and forth of like showing a draft to Maria in which you were very surprised by her commentary on something that you'd translated? Or did she have anything that surprised you?
No, I can't. I don't remember any.
Nothing but net. Catherine Silver, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing but the hits. That's so cool. Well, that's great. I'm sure that after the number of volumes you've translated and the fact that you've translated with Christoph before, I feel like after a while you probably just get a better sense of how to convey and translate things accurately.
I mean, I always make mistakes. And,
yeah.
I mean, you know, and she did correct a few things, but I wouldn't mm-hmm. say I was surprised. That's all.
Yeah.
Definitely there were backs and forth, and there were things I didn't quite understand. But I think there were a few sort of more sort of regional uses of certain words. I didn't know exactly what she was referring to,
mm-hmm.
Or little inconsistencies in the text
mm-hmm.
That we, you know, and often it would be just, I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but there is something that's related to explosions mm-hmm. later on in the book. That'll be a good tease.
Yeah.
And there was this whole thing. There was this whole sort of exploration with her and me and the editors of should it be blasts or explosions, or how should we exactly describe this rather odd occurrence that happens.
Yeah. So if anyone has their finger over the order link and is kind of hovering back and forth, you did hear correctly. There are explosions in this book. There are explosions, and you should check it out. Cool.
Explosions and bursts.
Bursts. Yep. There are bursts. yeah. Some trash is talked. Good times are had. So going diving into that kind of the Mara's strong willedness about language, but also her vow of silence as she's trying to live this quiet and detached life. Her internal monologue, as we're able to see in this narrative, we still end up experiencing such an ample amount of her strong opinions and her scheming, because the narrative, even though it's a third person omniscient voice, it's still it's very rooted in Mara's lived experience, Mara's observations in daily life. And the use of third person was something that really interested me in this book, because if I was to be writing this, I would think long and hard about whether to do first person or third person, just because the level of detachment creates kind of this sense of fascination with the character and kind of wondering if you're interpreting things right. But at the same time, the intimacy there is so palpable and real. So just from your lens as the translator, why do you think that Christoph opted for kind of a free and direct discourse third person instead of writing the story directly in Mara's first person?
I mean, I had exactly the same sort of questions when I first read it. I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
And I think you touched on two points. I mean, there are two sort of parts of that. One is, I think it allows Christoph to be as detached from Mara as Mara is trying to be from herself. There's this double distancing. It also, what it allowed Christoph to do, which I think is another really fascinating aspect to this book and adds a whole nother layer, is that this narrative, which is quite full of excitement and adventure, despite the fact that she wants nothing to happen in her life. A lot does.
Yeah.
And interspersed in this narrative are pages from her notebook. And at first, from a notebook. And at first, we don't know what this notebook is. We're not sure if it's Mara's notebook. But at a certain point, and I think it's okay to give this away. At a certain point, the use of the first person is used in one of the notebook excerpts. And these are notebooks are notes on books that were read, or exhibits that were seen, or something that was read online. And the eye comes in, and my understanding of that is these are the author's notes. This is what the author was reading. So it's an interesting kind of, it takes away the veil of the authorial distance or absence, and she puts herself into the book in a way.
Yeah.
So that also, if Mara was told in the first person, she wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah. It's kind of a meta narrative in a way that I found fun to be like, at first I was like, oh, does this museum belong to like someone who does curatorial work at the museum or something like that? And then kind of the Mara-ness of it all started to seep in. So it was like Mara's silent life becoming her spoken life, but also working on those two levels within her notebook. So I'm really glad you brought that up. I think that was a very fun fun little overlap, multi-layer Reese's cup of a treat.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, speaking of the voice and the person, and Mara's voice, using it and not using it, I'm going to do my best to discuss this without giving away the ending, but I promise everyone that the book is worth reading, even if you know what's happening, because the narrative voice is really weird and fascinating. So my favorite moment in the entire book is when Mara is at a bustling museum event with a lot of people. There are some donors. There are some locals. There's a lot going on. And the narrative says, everybody here seems to surpass her, Mara, in spades when it comes to the practice of a detached life, which she didn't achieve, as it turned out, for now at least. And I just love that because it seems like It is Mara experiencing like a personal growth moment or a new level of self-awareness. But then it kind of flips back where it's like, is this predicting Mara's future in the third person? Is this Mara having a little something to say about it in the first person? How do you feel about that moment, or how did you see it as you were translating it and working on it?
It's a good question. I mean, I think she's doomed to failure. her experiment of a year of silence, and a year of detachment and practicing detachment, it's all so deliberate. And it goes so much against the grain, which is one of the books she reads and that are in the notebook. It's interesting. The Huseman book. Mm-hmm. So against her grain, in a way, as an interpreter, as I was saying, because to be an interpreter or translator is to be deeply engaged, mm-hmm. and empathetic, meaning being able to enter the minds of other people. And Mara can't help herself. It's not just the external circumstances. It's not just because she has something to do with taxidermy. I won't give it away. Yeah. But it's sort of in a way it's her moment of recognizing that she might be able to move to a small town. She might be able to give up her international interpreting career. She might be able to take a vow of silence, but she can't really change fundamentally who she is. So there's that too, I think, that she can't disengage and that all these people around her could do it so much better than her without any effort.
Yeah, I mean, I guess interpreters got to interpret. And for her, interpreting in that moment was interpreting the world.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm just gonna gently tap one more thing without trying to give away anything major. Again, just to tantalize people to read this book, the story ended in a way that I really did not expect. And it ends in two characters feeling genuine satisfaction after a turn of events that I really didn't anticipate until towards the end of the book. And then how the characters felt about that event, also really surprised me. And it honestly felt kind of cute and heartwarming. So, do you consider this book to have a happy ending?
Wow. That's an interesting question. not for certain people.
Yeah.
or things. But for Mara, yes, I would say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say there is a kind of upbeat quality.
Yeah.
Not happy ending in the sense of, you know, married and lived happily ever after at all. But yes, I think you're right. I think there's something redeeming. And it's almost as if she will go on to have other adventures. Her life will not be uninteresting.
Yeah. And there's
neither
something
of their lives will be uninteresting.
For sure. And there's something that's distinctly both like individually empowering, but also interpersonal about the ending. At least I thought.
Between the two characters.
Yes. Yes.
Like yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. The two female characters.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. So if you are looking for something to read, listener friends, that involves explosions, female plot twist endings, vows of silence turning into conspiracies, Include Me Out by Maria Sonia Kristoff, translated by Catherine Silver. Catherine, are you working on any exciting translation projects right now, or how's your silent period going?
It's going well. It could have not coincided with a pandemic and a major upheaval, but it's fine. I've been working on some poetry. I just finished a book of translating a book of poetry by a Chilean poet, and that's going to be published soon. But other than that, I'm working on my own writing. Is there time to read another little piece?
There is. I would love to hear that.
Okay. This is just a little bit further into the book, but I think it doesn't need any introduction. I think it will be understood. And I think this gives a better sense, a good sense of Mara's personality.
Yeah.
Now she finally understands those women who sweep the sidewalks in front of their houses every Sunday. Their efforts are no longer unfathomable. There's fury, anger, rage, furiously angry rage behind it. Mara moves her chair to sweep underneath and over there also, between all the wheels on almost all the furniture in her museum room. As she sweeps, she touches those pieces with her broom, raising dust, disobeying as she sweeps all the rules they explained to her the first day. She almost knocks over the bust of Carola Lorenzini with a movement of her elbow, as if the poor thing hadn't already suffered enough from her fatal fall. She tries to dust the wheels of the snowplow, the first one that went to the South Pole. And when she approaches those wheels wrapped in chains so they could move through not only the snow, but also the unknown, she feels like climbing aboard, shifting into first gear and driving out of this room, plowing everything out of her way, exhibits, staff, visitors, stray dogs, other exhibits, thin walls, cabinets, street vendors, shop windows, street signs, more exhibits, hired help, cultural tourists, security people, suppliers, researchers, more exhibits, restorers, taxidermists, management personnel, whole collections not on display, collections on display, presidential carriages, assistants, possible donors, junk, one-of-a-kind pieces, onward and onward, flattening all of it and everything else, onward to the Soviet steppe such tractors know so well, onward to the island of Sakhalin, and who knows where else. Someone pssed to her from the door. She stops and hears someone asking her what she is doing in a tone of voice marked by that prosody of reprobation, which only guards who belong to the category replacements have the right to use. A category that does not underscore, in this universe, the implied precariousness of the terms of their employment, but rather other connotative lines that are much more à la page, such as nomadism, diversity, transculturalism. Also, as opposed to simple guards who spend hours sitting on their only chair, replacements circulate from room to room, as well as alternate between the front door, the boss's office, the garden if the weather is good, the security post, even the director's study. And in so doing, their permanently nomadic state lends them power because of its implicit cosmopolitanism and their resulting privileged access to gossip. Replacements are the divas of the guards, and they know it. And from that position, this particular one asks Mara what she is doing, why she is cleaning the room today when cleaning day was yesterday. I'll stop there. I think we're almost out of time, no?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That was a great segment to share with us. And I just want to say that it has been so much fun to have you on the show. I really appreciate the gift of your time. And
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this book. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. Friends and listeners, if you could look for Include Me Out, it's a wonderful read. And thank you, Catherine Silver, for joining us tonight. Bye-bye. Take care.
Thank you, Annie, for giving me the chat. Bye-bye.